This is Knives in the Water, a Star Trek reboot mobster AU, written by Green Post-it, art by Steam Pilot, read by Raina Jenkins. The story is rated NC-17, pairing James Kirk, Leonard Nicoy, with warnings for torture, violence, and abuse. Part 1. The letter arrives on a Tuesday. McCoy notices the handwritten envelope stuck between a Fong's takeout menu and a Pizza Hut flyer. The return address is a hospital in San Francisco, a place called St. James Medical. "I've been following your work for a while," the letter opens. It's a straightforward scouting letter, right up until McCoy realizes who wrote to him. The shock of seeing Arnab Puri's signature at the bottom of the page nearly inducing a heart attack. The letter ends with, "I want you in my hospital, Dr. McCoy." McCoy boxes up his meager belongings in less than 3 hours, calling the moving trucks at night. He's in California 2 days later. The move is drastic, but Arnab Puri is the kind of doctor McCoy's always wanted to be like. He grew up reading medical journals packed with Puri's brilliant observations and cutting-edge procedures that revolutionized neurosurgery in ways that Cushing and Penfield could only ever have dreamed. The job is an opportunity to work with the greatest medical mind of his time, and McCoy knows that. He finds a cheap two-bedroom apartment within walking distance of the hospital, and the caretaker, Gayla, is a friendly redhead who owns the vegan bakery below. It takes 2 coats of white paint to cover up the stained, chipped walls, but when the sunlight pours through the windows and floods his apartment, everything looks a whole lot cleaner and a whole lot more like home. McCoy is at St. James Medical for 3 days when Puri pulls him aside and makes an announcement. He's just about to leave for the day when Puri tells him that a New England socialite was flung from her horse at a showing, and her husband was willing to pay his astronomical consultation fee and fly him out for an examination. Puri leaves at night, says he'll be back in 4 days. When McCoy asks who the interim head of the department is, Puri laughs and claps him on the shoulder, looks at him with pale, clear eyes, and smiles. "He does this sometimes," Chapel shrugs when McCoy tells her. "He'll be back soon enough." It's 10 to midnight on the 5th day of Puri's absence. McCoy's waving goodnight to the nurses when half a dozen bloodied men in long black coats burst through the entrance doors. McCoy recognizes one of the men instantly, has seen his face on the evening news and in the morning paper. James Kirk is the Californian golden child, the youngest DA in the state, the attorney all the celebrities turn to when they're caught with drugs or whores, the man whose father spent his whole career chasing down the scum and scourge of the city and was killed as a result. "Where the fuck is Puri?" Kirk barks, wipes away the blood dripping off his forehead. A tall man with a stoic face and tattoos creeping up his neck steps forward as Chapel and Ramirez appear with a stretcher. McCoy sees the crumpled ball of a person in the man's arms, sees the blood dripping from the man's fingers like a running faucet, sees the neon lights of the parking lot highlight the puddles of blood on the cement outside like silver coins. McCoy's instincts kick in sharply. Even from across the room, he knows exactly what's happened. Smells the sweat and the gunpowder, can taste the copper on his tongue. He manages to get one hand on the bleeding body, and Jesus, it's just a kid, before two objects are unceremoniously jabbed into the gut and his back. He looks down and sees the muzzle of a gun aimed at his stomach. "Fuck off," a handsome Asian man threatens coolly. The gun low on McCoy's spine slides right over his T7 vertebrae. "Where's Puri?" "Puri's not here," McCoy snaps, and Kirk's eyes narrow in frustration. "Who the fuck are you?" Kirk's voice is so sharp, McCoy can feel his skin chafe. Kirk's eyes are hard and furious, and so blue McCoy's halfway torn between being hypnotized and seasick. "Jim," the tall man warms, his bloody fingers pressed against the 4 bullet holes ripped in the kid's white shirt. "He's going to bleed out," McCoy says gravely. Kirk looks down at the curly-haired boy on the stretcher, at his clammy, chalk-white flesh. Kirk's entire body tenses once before he withdraws his gun. McCoy inhales the same way he does when he comes up for water. "Sulu." Kirk motions absently with his hand, and the gun on McCoy's spine vanishes. "Spock, supervise." The tall man respectfully nods, and McCoy's focus immediately pulls on the boy. presses his fingers against the vein in his throat and helps steer the stretcher to the OR. There's still a pulse, but just barely. The kid's name is Chekhov. He's got a mop of curls glued together with tacky blood and barely looks old enough to be up this late. When McCoy cuts open Chekhov's shirt, he's genuinely stunned to see the age-faded ink etched into his skin. Chekhov looks like a human canvas, has tattoos running up his arms, his neck across his heart, his lethe-punctured chest stained just as black as it is red. McCoy might be new to California, but he's no idiot. Knows gang tattoos when he sees them. All the bullets are through and throughs. McCoy's worked on gunshot victims before, all hunting accidents that meant playing hide-and-seek with buckshot fragments. But nothing's ever been quite as bloody as what he's doing now. Chapel, a woman with hands as sure and steady as any surgeon he's ever known, shakes like a rattle. If her eyes aren't on heart monitor, they're on Spock, watching every twitch in his expressive eyebrows the way a condemned man looks at the gallows. She's absolutely terrified. By the time McCoy stabilizes Chekhov, his heart rate is holding strong and the front of McCoy's dress shirt is crusted with dried blood. Only when the bag of AB positive is halfway gone and the color returned to Chekhov's cheeks does Chapel take her first easy breath since the men burst into the lobby. When McCoy allows Chekhov to be wheeled to the recovery ward, three men with necks the size of phone books take his stretcher and guard him like gargoyles. Chapel directs them to a private elevator that leads to the top floor in a private recovery room. McCoy's been at St. James for a week, and this is the first time he's heard of the room. Looking at the poorly concealed guns the men are packing, he figures that might be the point. By 3 a.m., Chekhov is officially out of the woods. McCoy is exhausted, his adrenaline completely drained, leaving him with stiff joints and blurry vision. He quickly jots Chekhov's vitals on his chart and is about to leave when the door to the recovery room audibly clicks shut. McCoy turns to see Kirk leaning against the doorframe, his long black coat draped across his shoulders. The hospital is a brightly lit establishment, but it doesn't hold a candle to the lighting in the recovery room, to what the neon does to Kirk's eyes. Kirk notices McCoy staring, and his smile instantly sharpens. His eyes whip around McCoy's body, leaving him feeling violated and naked in their wake. There's an edge to Kirk's gaze that reminds McCoy of a starving lion. Dangerous. You're going to tell me what happened here? He gestures towards Chekhov's body, wonders what kind of elaborate lie Kirk will have at his disposal. Hunting accident, Kirk counters with ease, right on cue. With 9mm handguns? McCoy snaps. Kirk shrugs, guileless, and McCoy lets his irritation build around him like a shield. Just how thick do you think I am? Kirk smiles with pearly white teeth, gracefully pushes off the doorframe. He makes his way to McCoy and leans in without any regard for McCoy's personal space. Not an invitation to find out, Doc? The amusement in Kirk's voice is smoky, inviting, his tongue seductively wetting his lips. But McCoy doesn't focus on the path of that pink tongue. This close, all McCoy can see are the beads of sweat that dot Kirk's forehead, the smell of blood strong and spicy like his expensive cologne. McCoy ignores the blue of Kirk's eyes and looks down, sees Kirk's right hand tucked under the jacket. McCoy grits his teeth, wonders how long Kirk was planning to let his wound go unattended. You idiot! He hisses and grabs Kirk above the elbow. He manages to steer Kirk backwards a step towards the closest bed when Kirk unceremoniously shoves his gun into McCoy's stomach. You must have a serious death wish, Doc. Kirk's playful attitude vanishes like a streak of lightning, his features twisting into the ugly scowl from before. I'm not the one walking around with a bullet hole in my side, McCoy spits, his accent thickening. You're looking to die of sepsis? For his part, Kirk makes no further move. He stares into McCoy's eyes like he's assessing the situation, as if he's trying to figure out if he can trust McCoy, as if the last 3 hours of McCoy's life didn't involve him pulling chunks of metal out of Chekhov's body. You're not scared, Kirk observes, waving the gun in his hand threateningly. I'm from the South, kid, McCoy says flippantly. If you think this is the first time I've had a gun pointed at me, you'd be damn wrong. Kirk laughs, loud and rich and hearty, but doesn't holster the weapon. Instead, draws his hand from beneath his coat. The blood slicking his fingers doesn't surprise McCoy at all. Kirk's expensive designer dress shirt is soaked through on the left side, the stain spreading from his thick leather belt to his armpit. McCoy does a poor job wrangling his irritation. "Sit and lose the shirt, now," he commands. Kirk does, pops the buttons open with one hand, lets the fabric part around his tan, lean torso. Shocked, McCoy continues, "And the pants." Kirk's chuckle is a decadent, throaty sound. He loosely hooks his right leg behind McCoy's knees, pulls him in, and lifts his hips up off the bed in blatant invitation. He might as well start practicing. When McCoy realizes Kirk is waiting for him to undo the buttons of his pants, he comes dangerously close to violating the Hippocratic Oath. He settles for jabbing Kirk with 5 cc's of morphine. The cold tip of the gun instantly slides under McCoy's chin, forces his neck back uncomfortably. Kirk's expression is steely and menacing, his handsome features twisted. McCoy's temper boils, his irritation flooding through him like an internal bleed. He gets bold, curls his fingers around the gun, and pulls it from under his chin, keeping his eyes level with Kirk. When he licks his lip, Kirk's attention instantly drops, focuses there with genuine lust pooling in his blue eyes. "You play dirty, Doc," Kirk tisks like a disapproving elementary school teacher, his eyes glassy and wildly blue. He doesn't sound angry, more fascinated, like McCoy is the first person to disobey him. But distracting me with that pretty mouth will only work once. McCoy is about to snap at Kirk, but Kirk grabs his hair, tightens his fingers, yanks his head back painfully. "Get to work," Kirk commands, abrupt and cold. All traces of his former playfulness quenched. McCoy seethes, but finally focuses on Kirk's injury. He pushes Kirk's pants low enough to get to the bullet hole, and pauses when he sees a row of 3 black stars outlined in the defined cut of Kirk's pelvis. There's a matching set tattooed on the opposite groove. The bullet hole isn't very deep, but the skin around the wound is an ugly black, burnt and infected. McCoy is not a betting man, but he'd wager every penny in his bank account that if he were to line Chekhov up with Kirk, their bullet holes would match. Kirk keeps his fingers in McCoy's hair, absently pets the entire time, his breath heavy and persistent on McCoy's neck, until McCoy pushes Kirk back and grumbles about how he's acting like a starved dog with a bone. Kirk chuckles at the joke and falls asleep the second McCoy presses a sterile bandage against his skin. McCoy has to detangle Kirk's fingers from his hair, awkwardly lays them across Kirk's chest as he pulls up a thick medical blanket. Sulu appears beside him without McCoy even hearing him enter, squeezes McCoy's upper arm and drags him from the room with a sly smirk on his lips. Kirk and Chekhov are gone when McCoy begins his next shift. Chapel goes on as if the previous night never happened. Hands him his charts with the same steady professionalism he's grown accustomed to, and promptly vanishes for the rest of her shift. Around 6 a.m., McCoy heads to his office for a break, wonders where the hell Puri's been these past few days, and nearly drops his coffee all over the front of his shirt when the lights brighten the room. Kirk and Spock are already there, Kirk sitting in his chair with his feet propped up on McCoy's cluttered desk. Spock looks just as calm and collected as he did the previous night, his eyes cold and detached, but blazing with curiosity. McCoy instinctively squeezes his coffee cup tighter, lets the heat scald his palm. Kirk grins at McCoy and snaps his fingers. Spock immediately hands Kirk a folded piece of paper before he leaves the room, shuts the door behind him. Kirk stares at McCoy, licks his lips, and smiles like a shark. "This," he shakes the paper, "is a shut-your-fucking-mouth check. You get to keep it if you shut your fucking mouth." McCoy twitches. He's so insulted that for a minute, all that comes up is blind rage and indignation. Kirk continues unperturbed. "You won't file any official reports. You won't mention this to anyone. You didn't see anything last night. In fact, last night never happened. Comprende, Doc?" "Get the fuck out of my office." McCoy's voice is even and flat, betrays the feelings crashing under his skin. He doesn't think he's ever been so offended, so patronized, in his whole life. He hasn't felt such raw fury burn in his gut since he was 18 and stupid and so dead set in his convictions he bled for them. Kirk's expression immediately darkens. I wouldn't do this if I were you, McCoy, he warns tightly. I'm not on your payroll, Kirk. I'm not going to risk my goddamn medical license like some back-alley doctor just because you expect me to roll over at your fucking command. Kirk's smile returns to its full force, his eyes so captivating that McCoy feels their magnetic force trying to suck him in. Kirk stalks towards McCoy like a conquering emperor, with regal grace, and McCoy feels pinned to the spot, flayed open like a butterfly pinned on a corkboard. I don't expect, he purrs, lets his eyes hungrily drag up and down McCoy's body. But a guy can always hope. McCoy's patience finally snaps at the innuendo in Kirk's voice. He opens the door, pointedly stares. Goodbye, Mr. Kirk. Instead of leaving, Kirk quickly wraps his hand around McCoy's tie and backs him up against the wall. McCoy's coffee drops to the ground and Kirk presses in, slides his body against McCoy's, glues their thighs together like a vacuum seal. Kirk slips the folded check into the front pocket of McCoy's lab coat, drags his long fingers down McCoy's chest, and makes McCoy's entire body tense. When Kirk glances up at him through the fan of his pale eyelashes, he looks like an invitation to every sin his mama used to pray against when he was younger. Kirk licks his lips, and McCoy zeroes in on his shiny pink mouth, can practically feel the slippery heat against his cock. Kirk smiles like he's won the lottery. I see you around, Bones. Kirk's out the door before McCoy can suck in air for his starving, burning lungs. Kirk looks over his shoulder, smirks victorious, and winks. McCoy yanks the check out of his pocket and rips it into 8 pieces. McCoy gets home after the longest double he's ever pulled. He's so exhausted he hits his bed fully dressed and sleeps for 8 uninterrupted hours. When he wakes up, he's achingly hard and sweaty, and there's a lingering, haunting longing that burns deep and dark in his gut. He purposefully avoids looking at the newspaper and seeing Jim Kirk's handsome square face, and spends the whole day haunted by dreams of cutting his mouth on the sharp outline of black stars. Part 2. The gifts begin to arrive the next day. At first, it's a heavy china mug with an anatomically correct skeleton decorating the outside, filled with coffee he thinks Chapel was kind enough to leave him before rounds. The mug seems custom fit to his grip, has a thick handle and a wide rim, doesn't burn his palms the way the paper cups in the cafeteria do. The following day, the staff room has a brand new espresso machine that comes with coffee so rich and dark, McCoy finds himself licking his lips all day trying to savor the taste. The cafeteria changes food supply companies 3 days later, and the gray gruel disguised as the basic elements on the food pyramid disappears and is replaced with meals patients actually eat instead of dumping in the trash next to them. A week later, Kirk shows up as McCoy is signing the delivery slips to a brand new MRI machine the hospital desperately needs, but he can't find a purchase order for it anywhere. Kirk lingers by the door, hands shoved into pockets of his perfectly tailored navy blue pants, a sky blue button down only emphasizing the blue of his eyes, supervises with a devious smile. Kirk never says anything, just wanders around the hospital until McCoy's shift is over, and waits inside his office, no matter how many times McCoy makes sure the door is bolted shut. On the third day of Kirk flipping through the charts on his desk, McCoy loses his patience. What are you doing here? You haven't cashed your check. Kirk smiles insufferably wide. McCoy scoffs. Pretty hard to cash something in pieces. Kirk's silent for a long stretch of time, contemplating. Then, did you even look at it? Kirk asks, curious. Of course not, McCoy snaps, affronted. For a minute, Kirk doesn't say anything, doesn't move, doesn't even look at him. Then the smile that breaks out on his face floods the room the way the morning sun does his apartment. Amazing, Kirk replies earnestly, before he grabs his cream-collared jacket and walks out of McCoy's office without being asked. There are nights when the California air is so humid, it's sticky like fresh honey. McCoy feels compressed beneath the light cotton sheets on his bed, twists and turns until it's a damp, tangled knot around his ankles. Those nights when it's too hot to sleep, too hot to breathe, he finds his mind wandering, sleeps in a half-doze filled with dreams of fingers enclosed on his wrist, of nails digging into his delicate pulse, of teeth digging into his neck and biting down hard enough to bruise and swell. Fingers will slide into him and torture him for hours until he's shaking at the seams, so empty and desperate he'll whine and plead into his sweat-drenched pillow, never tries to fight the hands holding him down, seeks out the wet mouth that slides up and down his spine and takes apart his walls brick by brick, never bothers rebuilding, leaves him naked and vulnerable and baring his throat. When his alarm screeches and breaks him from his weak slumber, McCoy grinds his palm against his pounding dick and tries not to dwell on the images of black stars and blue eyes that have him coming so hard he goes blind. Kirk stops showing up towards the end of his shift, shows up every day on his clinic table instead. At first it's minor complaints, headaches, and mysterious pains that McCoy deals with as professionally and promptly as he can. After the third visit, Kirk seems to realize that McCoy will only touch him with his stethoscope and tongue depressors, quickly comes up with more elaborate illnesses and printed out with pages from WebMD that require McCoy's hands pressed against his firm chest, his sturdy back. "Ostlers?" McCoy balks at him, eyes scanning the page with the highlighted symptoms. "One goddamn nosebleed doesn't..." Kirk raises his palm, steals the word from McCoy's throat like a magician. "Why, Dr. McCoy, are you refusing me medical treatment?" Kirk hooks his leg behind McCoy's knee, tugs him forward like a petulant child. "You might be able to deny me certain things, Bones," he says, low and smooth, "but that's not one of them." McCoy seethes as he tips Kirk's head back, brushes his fingers up and down the slender curve of Kirk's nose, feels how soft the skin of his face is, and spends the rest of the day with the spicy, exotic smell of Kirk's cologne haunting him from room to room. 3 weeks after their first encounter, Kirk arrives with a legitimate medical condition. McCoy dreads removing the stitches from his bullet wound and gets a brand new look at the black stars that have been tormenting him for weeks. McCoy makes sure he keeps his gaze pinned firmly on the 6 black X's he sewed into Kirk's skin, and absolutely does not wonder if one touch along the sharp star outlines could cut his fingers. Kirk hums the whole time, swings his feet like a hyperactive child, and focuses his laser stare on the top of McCoy's head. "How's the kid, Chekhov?" McCoy asks, when the whole procedure is done and Kirk shucks on his pastel yellow shirt, his pants still riding low on his tight hips. Kirk has 2 more tattoos, more stars, one above each elbow, just as thick and black as the ones on his pelvis. "Surviving," Kirk replies candidly, doesn't immediately begin to button his shirt. McCoy looks pointedly at Kirk's chart, bites the inside of his cheek raw. "I want to see him again." McCoy's secretly been keeping an eye close on the obituaries, prays each day he doesn't find the name of a teenage boy removed from his care far sooner than he would have personally and ethically allowed. Kirk quirks an eyebrow, lips a thin white line on his face. "That's so." McCoy feels the air rippling around him, crackling dangerously. He holds his ground. "Yes." Kirk fastens every button of his shirt, tucks and preens until he looks like the pictures on the magazine covers McCoy passes in the supermarket checkout line. Kirk crowds McCoy's personal space, stares at him with blank, even expression that's gone like a streak of lightning, replaces a smile that steals the air from the room. "Fine," he agrees, simply. "But now you owe me." Kirk's gone before McCoy can splutter out his indignation. That night, Galen knocks on his door as he's getting ready for bed. She tells him there's a car waiting for him and says it with just enough alarm in her voice that McCoy forgoes dressing and goes outside. Sulu's leaning against a gorgeous BMW polished so brightly it stings McCoy's eyes. "Get in," he says flippantly, cracks his neck and reveals the black, yellow, green, and red swirls of a tattooed dragon's face swallowing 3 black stars. McCoy remains firmly rooted on the front door of Gala's bakery. Sulu opens the driver's side door, sighs as he glares at McCoy. "Now is really not the time to be stubborn, Doc." McCoy reluctantly gets in the car, sliding against seats as soft as sun-worn butter. Sulu says nothing as he throws the car into drive and speeds off. It's a short drive, barely 5 minutes, before Sulu rolls down his window and reaches outside, plugs in a security code that makes the massive wrought iron gate swing open. The mansion Sulu pulls up to awes McCoy silent. Even before the engine's turned off, a supermodel of a woman exits the front door. She's dressed in an elegant pencil skirt and high-collared white blouse, her long hair pulled exquisitely from her gorgeous face and cascades down her back. Dr. McCoy, she greets with a firm handshake, reveals a delicately inked, thick band of tattoos around her wrist. Nyota Uhura, please, follow me. She leads McCoy through the twisting corridors decorated with tastefully chosen artwork and up flights of stairs with plush Persian carpets. The house screams opulence, regality. Uhura stops in front of a cherrywood door, knocks twice before she twists the knob. Kirk, Spock, and Chekov are inside. All three look up at McCoy's arrival. Spock instantly removes himself from Chekov's side, and McCoy moves towards the bed, places the back of his hand on Chekov's forehead, then neck, searches for any signs of fever. Kirk presses himself against McCoy's side. Happy? I want to examine him. He looks Kirk in the eye, won't budge. Kirk ponders his request, snaps his fingers, and Spock and Uhura close the door behind them. There's a stethoscope on the bedside table next to a bottle of painkillers. McCoy knows he absolutely did not prescribe. He listens for any sign of irregularity, but Chekov's heart pounds away, steady and even. There's no infection around the wounds, scar tissue sensitive and healing. Medically, Chekov is in near-perfect health for someone who took 4 to the chest and almost attacked twice under McCoy's hands. The tattoos still trouble McCoy. They start at his neck, swirl down his arms, and cover the back of his palms, and fingers roll up and down the sides and emphasize how pale his lithe body is. McCoy looked up one of the tattoos he remembers the clearest, the birds flying across the setting sun etched into Chekov's side. Knows it's a Russian mafia tattoo for freedom. Recognizes more from the webpage now that he can see them up close. Chekov's got a mob story scrawled into him like a history textbook. He's also got a row of stars arcing above his heart, right over a rose with a barbed wire curling around it. Any discomfort, kid? He finally asks, once he can't justify being in the room a moment longer. Kirk translates for Chekov in perfect Russian. Chekov shakes his head, blinks his eyes fawn wide. Yet, doctor. Curiosity sated, Bones? Kirk asks once they've left the room. Unease crawls up McCoy's spine, makes him jittery. Kirk's too close to him, his breath fanning across the back of McCoy's neck, directly responsible for the drop in McCoy's belly, the tingling in his cock that grips away the oxygen in his body. Kirk continues nonplussed. So, should I have Sulu drive you back, or should I just collect what you owe me now? I don't owe you anything, McCoy growls, digging the heel of his palm into his eyes, frustration stomping out the flame of arousal. What about all those presents I've been leaving you? Kirk asks innocently, sidesteps until he's got McCoy pinned between a desk and the banister. None of those little hospital additions you seem to be enjoying were cheap. McCoy glares until his eyes strain. You're goddamn delusional if you think... Kirk presses his finger against McCoy's lips, hard enough to cut him off. Oh, I can think of a few people who'd call me delusional if they knew I paid over $3 million for that ass of yours. McCoy's temper explodes in one firm strike, shoves Kirk so hard both his wrists crack, finds himself slammed against the firm wall, and instant later with both of his hands pinned above his head, Kirk's face centimeters from his. Let go. McCoy is impressed with how calm he sounds. I don't want to, Kirk says honestly, loosens his grip enough for McCoy to pull away. McCoy doesn't. Kirk smiles to himself as he crushes their hips together and ruts slow and easy, has McCoy's eyes rolling in back of his head at how fucking good it feels, how badly he's been aching for this. I know you want this just as much as I do. I can see it in you every time we're in the same room. You want me to hold you down. You want me to make you like it. And I can. Kirk's eyes are electrically blue and sincere. I will. Kirk's words are like liquid lead in McCoy's veins, makes his body sizzle and push against Kirk's hardening dick, makes him pant and squeeze his eyes shut when the world spins around him so quickly he gets dizzy. "Stay here tonight," Kirk half orders, half asks, mouths along McCoy's upturned chin and sucks at his jaw. Kirk releases both McCoy's wrists, but McCoy doesn't drop his arms, lets Kirk slide his fingers around his neck, slip his other hand into the loose elastic of his pants and cup his throbbing dick. McCoy bucks up and whines, and Kirk growls, low and feral, slots their lips together and storms his mouth like Normandy. McCoy returns the intensity, starving for Kirk's tongue, his hands uselessly claw at the back of Kirk's shirt with his dull nails, until his frustration demands he rip the material away, wants to touch and suck and lick at those tattoos so familiar to his dreams they're practically imprinted on the backs of his eyelids. There's a thundering in his skull that vibrates down his back, his body reflexively attempting to keep itself from suffocating when Kirk rubs his thumb over the head of his dick, laps against his tongue, and sucks hard enough McCoy damn near blacks out. Kirk knows exactly how to touch McCoy, how to overload his senses and break him. He feels his control dissipating, like steam, his common sense packing up and leaving him. He tries to cling tighter, wants as much as he can take, Kirk more than willing to give. The thundering suddenly seems real, the noise of feet crashing heavily upon steps, the sound of heavy breaths that aren't his or Kirk's. Kirk breaks away from McCoy's mouth with a barked, "What?" "Boss," Sulu stares anyway. "Sorry to interrupt, but he just hit." Kirk's entire body tenses, his nails digging into McCoy's hips and making him grunt. Kirk looks at him, his eyes racing up and down his flustered, flushed body. Back at Sulu and Spock, and he squeezes his eyes shut, tenses, and growls out a deadly, "God damn it!" that could strip the paint off walls. Spock clears his throat. "Jim, if..." "Tell Scotty vacation's over," Kirk snaps. "Be ready to leave in 4 minutes. Sulu and Spock respectfully nod and barrel back down the stairs. Kirk stares at McCoy with a manic edge to his eyes, desperation and lust mixed potently. "You," he begins, his words dissolving in a frustrated hiss. "Just don't you fucking move." His voice is as close to begging as McCoy's ever heard it. Kirk kisses him once more, clams his mouth like a victor on a battlefield. "Just fuck, don't move." He rips himself away, passes stiff hands through his blonde hair, and races down the stairs, cursing a blue streak. McCoy finds himself still leaning against the wall 5 minutes after Kirk left him, almost chokes on the humiliation of trying to strangle him. He swipes at his face, mentally chastises himself for acting like a teenager at a frat party, and marches out of Kirk's house, walks the 20 blocks to his apartment. When he gets home, he types Chekhov's name into Google. One link stands out among the masses. The article is 10 years old and about a Russian mob lord named Andrei Chekhov, who was sentenced to life without parole for his involvement with a gang known as the Family. The article comes with a picture of Andrei and an 8-year-old boy with wide eyes and a thick head of curly hair. Amongst the mess of tattoos on Andrei's body, the simple outline of 3 black stars along his neck stands out sharply, the exact same stars he's seen on Kirk's hips, Spock's arms, Sulu's neck, Uhura's wrists, and Chekhov's chest. He searches for the Family, adds in everyone's names, pulls up pages of articles on the Lebanese ambassador's son and his speculated ties to Hezbollah and plutonium smuggling, the daughter of a Nigerian warlord with black market weapons ties, the Yakuza gun for hire with a $400,000 bounty on his head, the Scottish-born IRA demolition specialist responsible for the bombings that killed the Irish president. Then there's Kirk, the only son of the late D.A. George Kirk, the man who built the city, the man responsible for the sharp decrease in crime, the man who went after the tyrants and the scum and made the streets safe again. When George was shot outside the courthouse in a gang-organized hit, the entire city mourned. There's only one picture McCoy can find, a picture of George and his family taken at a barbecue, holding a little boy with stunning blue eyes that's tugging the collar of George's t-shirt low enough to reveal 2 black points that would connect into a star if traced. The dread that sloshes through McCoy's belly is freezing cold, makes him nauseous. He thinks about that first night he met Kirk and his gang, at the promptness of the nurses, at the checks circulated the next morning. how everyone was practiced enough to avoid any and all mentions of the group of men shot in the middle of the night. McCoy tries not to think about what it means, but already knows it in the pit of his stomach. Puri shows up the next morning and acts like him being away 3 weeks longer than he said he would is perfectly excusable. He claps McCoy on the shoulder and congratulates him on a job well done and promptly disappears into his office to tackle the paperwork left by his absence. McCoy's temper hits critical mass, and he's snappish and rude for the rest of his shift. His bedside manner was never his selling point, but McCoy likes to think his gruff candor is refreshing. He's aware he's being anything but when he snaps at Hannity for handing him the wrong chart, and barks at Chapa when she takes a phone call from her boyfriend. McCoy's been a doctor long enough to know sexual frustration isn't a legitimate medical symptom for being an asshole, but he spent half the night looking for every article he could find concerning the family, and the other half trying as hard as not to picture Kirk when he came. The family has their fingers in every illicit, illegal, black market operation known to man. Terrorism, assassinations, narcotics smuggling, money laundering, gun running. The laundry list of felonies goes on and on, each member more wanted than the last. Apparently, the heads of every major global mob family came together and joined forces. Everyone shares in a piece of the pie, the money probably filtered through Ponzi businesses and IRS loopholes. Like St. James. McCoy thinks of the brand new MRI whirling away in the basement, how someone's blood-stained corpse probably paid for the delivery and installation. McCoy looks down at the gourmet quiche he's eating, at the piping hot coffee in his brand new mug. He's suddenly not hungry anymore. Part 3. The door clicks shut as McCoy gathers his things to leave. When he turns, he's not shocked to see Kirk leaning against the door. "You weren't waiting when I got back," Kirk begins, tucks his hands in his pockets. McCoy keeps his jaws shut, focuses on shoving some charts he needs to revise into his briefcase. Kirk shrugs his shoulders, loosens the midnight blue tie around his neck, his cuffs already rolled up to the elbows, and locks the door with a deafening click. "My right hand wasn't exactly the company I was expecting last night, you know." Kirk rolls his wrists, lets the rhythmic snap, crack, crack echo. "I only got through my night knowing that when I got home, I'd pin you to my bed and wear your legs like a choker. Instead, I come back to an empty house." "You left," McCoy says simply, snaps his case shut. "I had some business that needed my immediate attention," Kirk deflects absently as he stalks toward McCoy, the exact same way he did when they first met. "More hunting?" McCoy spits bitterly. Kirk smirks, licks his lips predatorily. "Something like that." McCoy scoffs. "Like mob business?" Kirk freezes for all of a second, before his lips turn into a disarming smile meant to cripple McCoy's resolve. It doesn't. "Impressive. It took Scotty getting his face hacked up by Irish terrorists for Perry to come to that conclusion." "So it is true." "An admission isn't what McCoy expected." "I never said that," Kirk counters in full-on attorney mode. He makes his way to McCoy's desk, casts his gaze on the coffee stand mug, and smirks. "However, I am saying that if your allegations were in any way true, I'd be impressed with your initiative." "Get out!" McCoy means every word. The fight rolls through him like a sleeping tiger being poked. "No." Kirk shakes his head, comes around the desk, crowd McCoy's face. Much like the previous night, McCoy's instincts have him pushing Kirk away, and much like the previous night, Kirk grabs McCoy's wrists in his hands, presses both of his palms against the arms of his chair, and forces him into a sitting position. Kirk smiles as he straddles McCoy, slots their bodies together, and runs both his hands through McCoy's hair, forces McCoy's head back. "Get off of me!" McCoy growls, strains the muscles of his legs and back, trying to propel Kirk off of him. But Kirk is glued to him so firmly, McCoy can feel Kirk's heart pounding against his, can feel the hard outline of his thick cock digging into his belly. Kirk stares at McCoy like he's been given his pick of prizes, and the arrogance renews McCoy's struggle. Kirk moves quickly, presses advantage, licks across McCoy's lips, dives in, opening McCoy's mouth with his tongue and bringing a flood of fire with him. Kirk rocks down and grinds their cocks together, and McCoy hisses, bites down hard on Kirk's bottom lip, and fights how badly his body still wants this. Kirk claws at the buttons of his shirt, rakes his nails down McCoy's chest, and tries his hardest to taste every inch of McCoy's mouth all at once, moans and crushes their hips together when McCoy bites again, this time sucking Kirk's lip into his mouth as McCoy's body betrays his better judgment. Kirk pulls away, completely reluctant, and looks into McCoy's eyes. "This is what's going to happen," Kirk begins, speaking with absolute certainty, cheeks flushed and lips bitten red. "I'm going to get Sulu to pull the car around." He tears away the zipper to McCoy's pants, gets his fingers on McCoy's dick, and robs McCoy of the last of his meager fight, staunches McCoy's resistance, and makes him curl up into Kirk's fist, lets loose a throaty moan that makes Kirk hiss. "And after I ruin these nice pants of yours, I'm going to take you back to my house and spend the whole weekend riding that ass of yours like it's my personal thoroughbred." McCoy whines, high and strangled, and snarls as his nails dig into Kirk's back, drags down in a way that's got to ache. Kirk hums in encouragement, begins stroking his dick in earnest, rubs right under McCoy's head, and twists his wrist until McCoy moans loudly, his vision fuzzing and blurring. "Do that again," Kirk demands breathlessly, his control crumbling, the need breaking his voice. He twists his wrist again, damn near makes McCoy buck off the chair as he groans and pants. Kirk growls, feral and honest. "That's not it. Again." McCoy obliges, and Kirk shakes his head, bites his bottom lip. "Again." The orgasm pools hot and livid in McCoy's gut, makes his body sing. His cock is burning hot, the pain in the center of his chest tight and clawing. Kirk keeps on stroking him, keeps him on the edge of coming like a perfectly balanced tightrope walker. McCoy can't stand the teasing, needs to stop the fire burning his body to ash. Kirk doesn't seem fazed, keeps up his torturous pace even when McCoy bruises his hips, digs his nails into the stars and scar tissue, and bites Kirk's tongue to stifle his scream. "Come home with me," Kirk half orders again. McCoy comes mouthing yes into Kirk's neck. They spend the entire weekend in Kirk's bed. McCoy has never been shy about his body, but the way Kirk stares at him when he's fully naked would make an escort blush. There's a good hour where Kirk straddles McCoy's hips and explores his mouth, licks and sucks away at McCoy's lips until they feel chafed and tender, until all McCoy can taste is the salt of Kirk's mouth and feel the rough brush of Kirk's tongue against his palate. There's so much lube spilled between them, their chests are as slick as a slip and slide, McCoy's legs hooked over Kirk's broad shoulders, his knees bumping into his shoulders as Kirk drills into him and sets off the sharpest, most blinding stabs of pleasure he's ever experienced. Kirk's hands never leave his body, his mouth lapping up the beads of perspiration sliding down McCoy's neck and chest. Makes him come and come until McCoy's overstimulated skin sizzles. At one point, Kirk has to pin McCoy's arms over his head, McCoy's nails clawing uselessly on smooth, silky sheets, Kirk's cock rocking into him and Kirk's heavy hands the only parts of him touching McCoy. McCoy rots against the bed like a cat in heat. He tries to pull away when Kirk comes, his body so sensitive he feels the spray of Kirk's cum in his ass, and curls in on himself to calm his heart, but Kirk hushes him and rolls him back onto his back, sucks on his nipples and hips until McCoy's body forces out another weak, blank orgasm that robs McCoy of his vision for 7 minutes. "Too much for you?" Kirk asks the next morning, his fingers skimming along McCoy's cum-sticky hole, his cock boiling hot and hard against McCoy's leg. It's a challenge, and McCoy glares, bites down on Kirk's tongue as he slides inside his body with absolutely no resistance at all, his ass already stretched and loose and slick with cum and lube from hours before. The pleasure is sweet, continuous. Kirk explores every inch of him, uses his tongue to guide the path of his fingers, maneuvers McCoy's body like he's known it his whole life, makes his brain fizzle and dissolve, and McCoy can't reciprocate fast enough. When Monday comes around, McCoy is stiff and the bruises and scratches are still fresh and sore, and the thought of spending the next 10 hours in a hospital, standing, walking, is so unappealing he momentarily relapses into the boy who used to hide under his covers in hopes his mama wouldn't wake him up for school. "You're not moving," Kirk speaks into his stomach when McCoy tells him he has to leave, licks along the hairs low on his belly until McCoy arches away. Not now that I have you here. You're not going anywhere. Jim, his voice falters, when Kirk's tongue slides along his cock, takes him into his mouth, and sucks him into a state of lucidity. Hours later, when McCoy wakes from a light slumber, he hears Kirk on the phone with Puri, telling him that McCoy won't be in for the next 2 days. Kirk sounds so smug and pleased that McCoy's cock twitches despite himself. 2 days is a promise, and something McCoy learns quickly that Kirk never breaks his promise. McCoy has no idea why he expected Kirk's constant presence at the hospital to stop once he got McCoy between his sheets, but he did. Suffice it to say, when McCoy shows up to his first appointment of the day, seeing Kirk's smiling face in exam room 7 makes him stop dead in his tracks. Kirk blinks innocently as he evenly informs McCoy of the ache in his cock that he's positive only McCoy can remedy. "Apply a liberal application of your hand and stop bothering me when I'm at work, Jim." He glares, amused but irritated, until Kirk breaks into a smile and hooks his legs around McCoy's waist. "That won't work, Bones," he says matter-of-factly. "I'm not my type." McCoy sighs. "Don't you have a job to be at now?" "DA is the easiest job in the world when you control the crime," Kirk grins, confesses his sins breezily. McCoy doesn't like the feeling that creeps into his gut whenever Kirk gives him another piece of ammunition, when he cinches the invisible bonds tighter. There's a rational being inside of McCoy that he's been ignoring ever since Kirk stormed into the hospital, one that's given up on McCoy and his predicament, feeds him to the proverbial sharks. Kirk looks like he's starving. 77 kilos of heroin are seized in a police raid on Tuesday, and the press goes wild. McCoy's watched the evening news for the last 3 nights, has seen Kirk speak on behalf of the DA's office, fields wave after wave of questions with earnest charm, talks his way out of questions that he can't answer with an alacrity that impresses McCoy. A week goes by without McCoy seeing him at the hospital. He never realized how much of his day became him avoiding Kirk to complete his rounds, how his lunches consisted of Kirk trying to con him into a supply closet quickie while they ate in his office. McCoy wouldn't go so far to say he missed Kirk's company, but when Kirk shows up on Saturday, McCoy is the first to reach out and touch his face, lets his fingers graze the pockmark area around his chin, and goes easily into the kiss Kirk initiates. Kirk's lips are warm and dry, his fingers curling around McCoy's wrist. When Kirk pulls away, he rests his head on McCoy's shoulder, inhales loud enough for McCoy's lungs to ache in sympathy. "I really fucked myself over with that bust," he says when he pulls away. "There's some family business going down right now. It'd be safer for you if you stay away from me a while, okay?" McCoy runs his hand across the back of Kirk's skull, nods and feels his body's sigh in sync with Kirk's. Kirk rests his head against McCoy's shoulder again, inhales calm and steady, makes a soft sound of approval when McCoy keeps stroking his hair. Kirk's cell phone rings almost 5 minutes later. "You have to go?" "In a minute," Kirk mumbles against his shoulder. Puri finds them in the same position 10 minutes later. The first time it happens, McCoy is at the food market. He's picking up eggs and milk when he realizes he left his wallet and his lab coat from his lunch date with Kirk. The owner laughs at his predicament, waves away his apologies, and places his purchase in a linen bag, hands it to him. He doesn't think too much of it, goes back and leaves the money with an employee the next day. The second time is at the dry cleaners, when a week's worth of his suits are handed to him before he can produce the ticket. It's a trend that begins to happen to him everywhere, his temper near volcanic when the cashier at his favorite Indian restaurant tells him, "Friends of Mr. Kirk don't pay." "Call them off, Jim," he warns Kirk the next day when he sees him. Doesn't like the imbalance, the connotations. Kirk's been kind enough to keep McCoy out of any and all business related to the family, waits for him to leave the room before he'll discuss anything with Spock or Uhura. What's been happening lately makes him feel seedy, dirty. Kirk doesn't ask for any clarification, always knows exactly what McCoy's talking about. His blue eyes sharpen defensively, his body gearing up for the type of speeches he uses to wow jurors in court. McCoy cuts him off before he can build momentum. "I'm serious, Jim." "You don't like it?" Kirk says flatly, a half question. "No," he replies honestly. Kirk takes a long while before he responds. And you're going to ask me to stop doing it, too. Another half question. No, McCoy lies. Knows it's too much to ask a tiger to change its stripes. Kirk's impassive face breaks out in a smile. He pulls McCoy to his chest, slides the mouths together, and makes McCoy's lips ache when he pulls away. Yes, you were, Kirk smiles, eyes gleaming with unfiltered joy. McCoy has no idea how anyone with a face as revealing and honest as Kirk's could make a living as the world's best liar. Kirk kisses McCoy again before he nods against McCoy's mouth. Okay, I can do that. 4 months into his relationship, McCoy realizes he hasn't been to his apartment in 3 weeks. Sulu's always at the hospital, leaning against the sleek, polished BMW, and waits for him to get inside once his shift is over. Kirk's always in the back, always in the middle of rolling up his cuffs, and doesn't stop fidgeting until the tips of his fingers slide under the collar of McCoy's shirt to play with the ends of his hair. McCoy wakes up one morning with Kirk's arms wrapped around his hips, and for a moment he has no idea where he is. He jolts up. Kirk pulls him back down, tells him to go back to bed, and promptly falls asleep with his forehead sticking to the back of McCoy's neck. That day, he leaves the hospital early, goes to his apartment, and nearly suffocates without constricting the wide-open rooms suddenly feel. Kirk calls him exactly 30 seconds after the time he is usually in the back seat, and McCoy learned a long time ago that letting Kirk's calls go to voicemail ends with Spock and Kirk barreling through the hospital with guns drawn. He makes it a point to stay at his place at least 3 nights a week, manages to keep it up for almost a week before he comes home one day after a 10-hour surgery to find Kirk lounging in his kitchen, feet propped up on his table, insufferable smirk on his handsome face. McCoy pushes Kirk's feet off his table, scowls, and makes Kirk laugh. You're late, Bones, Kirk chides mockingly, waggles his finger. He pats his lap expectantly, and McCoy bypasses him and goes to the fridge, makes Kirk wrinkle his brows disapprovingly. Continuously indulging Kirk's whims only makes him more persistent, makes him greedier. It's an oddly endearing trait, and God knows it's hard to deny Kirk when he's rocking cock deep inside of him, but outside the bedroom, the little victories matter. Kirk doesn't take well to being ignored. He plasters himself along McCoy's back, looping his arms around McCoy's waist, and waits for him to finish his bottle of water before attacking the back of his neck with his mouth. Do I want to know how you got in? He asks, sags into Kirk's arms. Use the master key. Kirk's mouth wetly behind his ear, bites along his hairline. McCoy feels Kirk's smile against his skin. I own this building. McCoy sighs, breaks away. Is there anything in this state you don't own? Not really. Kirk moves right back in, grazes his teeth, nips playfully. He drops his hand until he's cupping McCoy's dick, kneads firmly while his lips flutter against the back of McCoy's neck, his tongue licking along slips of skin. McCoy rocks back into him, exhausted and hardening quick. Kirk's other hand is clamped firmly on his lower hip, fingers digging into the sore muscles near his back from being hunched over a body for 10 hours. Are you going to show me the bedroom? Kirk asks, keeping his voice pitched low and gravelly. Or am I going to have to make do in here? Jim, he starts, but Kirk is already leading him to his bedroom, to his bed, guides him onto his stomach and crawls up his legs, tugs his shirt from his pants. Kirk's always creative this time of night, and McCoy is too bone-tired to reciprocate. He's about to tell Kirk just that, when the heels of Kirk's hands dig into the stiff muscles of his spine and grind down. Kirk's fingers feel amazing, roll up and down his back and shoulders and sides, until McCoy is so pliant and relaxed, he finds himself drifting. You're way too tense, Len, Kirk states matter-of-factly. You have to start cutting back on your hours. But how else will I afford my rent? He deadpans, as Kirk hits a cluster of nerves so tight and aching, white static fizzles before his vision. I can think of a few ways to placate your landlord, Kirk jokes, keeping up his steady, even pressure, and works every last kink out of McCoy's body. He kisses his favorite spot behind McCoy's neck only once, doesn't tease or rut or make any move to entice McCoy into a happy ending. McCoy falls asleep once Kirk's stripped out of his shirt. Wakes up 2 hours later with Kirk propped up with pillows next to him, going over some of his case files for his trial the day after. "You hungry?" Kirk asks, looking away from the discovery. "I ordered some food from that place you liked last week." He reaches for McCoy's dresser, grabs the receipt to prove it. Kirk's wearing his glasses and McCoy's Ole Miss Med School t-shirt, his expensive clothing shucked off in a ball at the foot of McCoy's bed. The scene is so domestic, so familiar, that McCoy can only manage a nod and tries to swallow past the thick clump in his throat. Sometimes, there are days of such profound calm, McCoy scoffs at Scorsese and Coppola. They only go back to McCoy's apartment when Kirk has a trial to prep for, when McCoy has a lengthy surgery to rest for. They'll drag each other off to bed and sleep until the alarm blares, Kirk reluctantly unwrapping his body from around McCoy's to make coffee, while McCoy slouches off to shower to wake himself up. Most nights, he's at Kirk's mansion, makes a salad while Scotty and Chekhov communicate in an accent, mangled Russian-Scottish hybrid. He finds himself liking these people despite everyone being on Interpol and the FBI's most wanted lists. They're not what he expected them to be like, expected crueler souls and conniving motives, but finds that the family only functions as a single interlocking organism. Every person sitting around Kirk's large dining room table, sharing the steaks Spock always grills but never eats, would lay down their lives for the safety of another member. Chekhov has 4 clusters of scars on his chest to prove it. Scotty and his mangled face, where people Uhura's brothers screwed over, risked the flight over to teach her a lesson. Those nights, after a full meal and a round of strong drinks, McCoy will tug Kirk back to his room, will work away the buttons and clasps in his way, and will pull out every dirty trick Kirk ever taught him, will lick at the tight, firm muscles of his chest, will bite and suck until all 6 stars adorning Kirk's pelvis are bright red and black, will rake his teeth over the little protrusion on his belly button that McCoy enjoys more than he thinks Kirk realizes. For all the praise and promises concerning his lips that Kirk will filthily spout into his ear when bending him in half, McCoy has only gotten his mouth on Kirk's dick a few odd times in the last 9 months, only seems to be able to drop to his knees and stay there when Kirk is in a state of near unconsciousness. At first, McCoy was convinced it was a control issue, but after one particular night of continuous, quick, heavy drinking that had him sloppily smashing into every antique Kirk's home seems to contain, McCoy slipped to his knees and mouthed Kirk's cotton-covered dick until Kirk came, Kirk's fingers squeezing his hair as he hissed out how ruthlessly he wanted to fuck into his mouth, how he could only ever think of all the men who'd gotten there before him. Still, McCoy spends an exorbitant amount of time lavishing Kirk's hips and chest, only ever fully allows his id to run rampant when he has Kirk's knees squeezing around his ears, Kirk's cock inching further and further down the tight channel of his throat, Kirk's voice ragged and reduced to clipped sobs intermixed with low snarls. McCoy only ever really enjoys it, when Kirk stops trying to resist his orgasms, when he hits the point he snaps and rides McCoy's face like it's a race, McCoy loving every hard push that steals a fraction after fraction of his air until he's lightheaded and so hard his cock leaks like a sifter. When Kirk comes, McCoy closes his eyes, moans, always swallows as he comes, sees bright flashes of white when he opens his eyes, sees stars and knows that Kirk would make the joke if he could do anything besides gasp and growl. George wore the stars above his heart, Kirk above his cock. It's so fitting it makes McCoy chuckle. Sometimes, life with Kirk is so chaotic and turbulent, years are scared off McCoy's life. They're always brief, momentary flashes, never longer than 5 minutes, but the terror lingers in McCoy's gut for days. McCoy has never been a part of the actual brawls, but he's been there for the fallout of every round. McCoy's eyes have catalogued every bruise and cut on Kirk's chest, have tended to some of the bloodier gashes, and continues to do so, even though he tells Kirk he could have his medical license revoked if discovered. Kirk never asks him to help, but he does. The day he's actually stuck in the middle of Kirk's gang war is the day he's in the car with Sulu, Chekhov, Scotty, and Kirk on their way back from the fruit market. 2 red cars pull up next to either side of them and immediately open fire. The sound of the machine guns is like thunder. The windows shatter on both sides as the bullets hit the reinforced doors, echoes in the car like a drum. Everything is so loud McCoy's ears pop, his hearing fades in and out like the emergency warning broadcast on TV. Kirk instantly throws himself over McCoy, and Scotty covers Kirk and Sulu slams on the brakes hard enough to propel everyone in the back seat forward. Chekov launches half his body outside of its blown-open window, returns fire from the guns he keeps holstered at his sides, and the three loud pops of exploding tires tell McCoy he hit exactly what he was aiming for. "Anyone hit?" Sulu screams from the front. Chekov's thick Russian babbles nearly drown him out as he rips his shirt and presses the material against the oozing wound on Sulu's right arm. McCoy can smell blood near his face, pushes Kirk and Scotty off him, and the red drips down Kirk's cheek, has him turning to Scotty and the bubbling wound he's clamped down on his neck with his blood-drenched fingers. McCoy practically climbs over Kirk and squeezes his fingers around Scotty's neck as Scotty's eyes roll back, his body sagging. "Get us home now, Sulu!" Kirk barks. McCoy can still feel the pulse. The bullet that sliced into Scotty's neck was half a centimeter away from his jugular. He loses a pint of blood, but McCoy has become an expert at suturing bullet wounds in under 5 minutes. When they burst through the front door, Uhura kicks the decorative vases and centerpieces off the large table in the dining room. Kirk drops Scotty on the hard surface, and Spock assists in closing up the wound. After Scotty regains consciousness, still pale and clammy, Sulu sits down in his usual spot, and McCoy cuts away his shirt and jacket and gets his first solid look at the Yakuza dragon and koi fish vibrantly inked along every inch of his torso. Sulu barely says a word the whole time McCoy sews away, just sucks down shot after shot of sake, despite McCoy telling him not to. He tries to drown out the sound of Kirk swearing and shouting, at his loud proclamations that he'd kill Nero for this. McCoy's been trying not to listen for the past few months, but he's heard the end of conversations, knows that a rival mobster responsible for shooting up Chekov, how Kirk retaliated and took $4 million worth of his heroin. Tonight's drive-by was bold, more retaliation. McCoy knows it's not going to stop until one of them is dead. He arrives an hour before his shift starts to grab some supplies he's going to need for Scotty and Sulu. He makes his way to Puri, needs an internal requisition form, and sees the door to his office is partially open. He knows Puri is taking consults all morning, is startled when he overhears Puri's voice pitched high and scared, as he tries to explain something to a tall, bald man with jagged facial scars and tattoos and features chiseled out of smooth marble. The man is clearly unsatisfied, tells Puri he expects results, or else. As he stands to exit the room, Puri says, "Nero, you have to understand." McCoy freezes dead in his tracks. He tells Kirk about Puri when Kirk gets to his apartment that night. Kirk takes to the news as well as McCoy expected, punches a hole through McCoy's wall, and curses until his face turns bright red and his eyes burn like blue flames. He's on his cell phone a minute later, shakes the plaster out of his bleeding knuckles, and tells Spock about Puri and Nero. McCoy can only hear one side of the conversation, but he can picture Spock's calm responses, can see the linear progression of their conversation that begins with Nero's return to California and ends with Puri's disappearance the night McCoy got roped into this whole mess. "What does this mean?" McCoy asks, after Kirk's hung up and slammed back a shot of Johnny Walker Blue. He has a cigarette perched halfway between his lips, only smokes when he's contemplating something or after a good fuck, a habit McCoy has tried to break him of. He only managed to get addicted to the taste of nicotine on his tongue as his orgasm laps through every inch of his body. "That means you're getting a promotion soon," Kirk says evenly, coldly, as he blows out smoke. The words dig under McCoy's skin the same way they did at the beginning, when Kirk's superiority and arrogance offended every fiber of McCoy's being. "This is never going to end," McCoy snaps. "You're not going to be happy until you kill him, and he's not going to stop until he kills you. And you knew that, so don't go acting all magnanimous on me now, Doc. You're not exactly squeaky clean anymore yourself. This is who I am, what I do." "Get out," he orders. Kirk goes without hesitation. His alarm is set for 4 a.m., but McCoy hasn't slept. He showers and dresses mechanically, exhausted and weary, but somehow still manages to put one foot in front of the other and makes it to the front of the hospital an hour later than normal. All the lights are off in the lobby, which McCoy has never seen before. He speeds up as he makes it to the front doors, pushes them open, and nearly slips on something wet and slippery. He blindly makes his way to the nurse's station and turns on the lights Chapel keeps on the edge of the desk. He knows the breakers are next to the PA system, tilts the lamps and finds his way to the circuit box, flicks on the breakers, and watches as the lobby floods with light. All he sees are the bodies, sees the pools of blood staining the floor. Mbenga's tall, bowed body spread eagle on the floor, half a clip's worth of bullets pumped into his chest. McCoy numbly stumbles to his body, sees how his eyes are murky with lifelessness, has to turn over Hannity to see her throat cut open, Ramirez's gray matter staining the back of the wall she slumped near, the crater on the side of her head still dripping. There are dozens of bloody footprints and skid marks leaning in and out of the hospital, hundreds of bullet casings sprinkled around like confetti. All the footprints lead to elevators and stairs, down the halls and veer off into different wards. McCoy doesn't think. Races up the closest set of stairs, feels his heart throb in his throat, and his oxygen supply cut off when he pushes past the second floor door and hears the sounds of 150 heart monitors, all flatlining.